Bishus, Rav Cohen, Rav Reichman, Moran of Rabbanon. Over the last couple of weeks, we've had the opportunity here in the yeshiva to hear remarks and recollections concerning Moran of Rabbeinu, Harav Agona Adir, Yosef Dov, Halevi Soloveitchik, Zeron Roche, the Rav Zatzal, in commemoration of his 25th Yahrzeit, which took place on Chol HaMoed Pesach, from a number of distinguished Rosh Yeshiva and Rebbeim, who were all able to share reflections on the basis of their own personal experiences as Talmidim of the Rav, when he was at the pinnacle of his career, when his extraordinary skills and abilities were at their very best, and as Talmidim who were also able to forge a very close personal relationship with the Rav, Zichrono Livracha, being as they were among his most prominent Talmidim of the particular Tekufos when they learned by him. With that in mind, I have to begin my presentation here this evening with a bit of a disclaimer of sorts, stating that, at least from that perspective, I don't really feel fully qualified to be on this list of speakers, and certainly not the final speaker in this series, in tribute to the Rav, Zichrono Livracha. And I say that not because I'm trying to sound modest, or I'm trying to seem humble, you know, I'm not worthy and all that, but rather because of the simple fact that I was not zoche to see the Rav b'melo tokfo uv'rov gadluso at the height of his incredible power and at a time when his remarkable talents and indeed his great genius were so readily and regularly perceptible and evident to all. I had the schus to be in the Rav Shir in the late 1970s and early 1980s, more or less the last few years during which the Rav was able to say regular shiurim here in the yeshiva. And he was, by that time, considerably slowed by, I guess, the combination of advancing age and by illness, a debilitating illness, more than one illness. And he simply was not the person, the powerhouse that he once had been by the time I got to the shiur. Now that is not to suggest, chas v'shalom, for a moment, that we did not learn a lot from the Rav during those years, that we did not hear some great shiurim, that we did not get exposed to his brilliant and penetrating analysis, that we did not see his style of thinking, and we did not benefit from his clear presentation, whether we do not see his love for Torah and his love for teaching Torah and transmitting it to Talmidim, we certainly did. But looking back, I have to view my own experience during those years, and again, I speak only for myself and not for anyone else who was in the shir during that time, and there were certainly some outstanding Talmidei Chachamim who were there during those years. But speaking for myself, I think that my experience with the Rav is akin to what the Gemara says in Erevin and Daf Yud Gimel with Beis, in the name of Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda HaNossi, according to some versions was Rav, who said that he attributes the measure of his success in Torah to the fact that Chazise L'Reb Meir Me'achorei. He says, I saw Reb Meir, the great Tana Reb Meir, Stam Mishnah Reb Meir. I saw Reb Meir Me'achorei, from the back, from behind. There are different interpretations of exactly what that means. The simple pshat that Rashi follows is that the Beis Medrash, I guess, at that time was set up more or less like this, that there were people when the presenter of the shir, the Rebbe stood, so there were people who saw from the back. And that's what Rebbe or Rav was saying, that he saw Reb Meir from the back, meaning that he missed, as the Marshal elaborates, certain facial expressions and hence certain nuances that perhaps were part of the presentation. But others understand that what the Gemara means is that Rebbe, and this is certainly what seemed to be the case if the speaker was Rav, There was a young Talmud who was in the shiur, who heard the shiurim delivered by a much older Rebbe in Rosh Hashiva, who perhaps was slowing down, perhaps was winding down in terms of his tenure as the Rosh Hashiva. And this young Talmud saw the Rebbe from behind, meaning he didn't see the full picture. He didn't see the full countenance. And that's, again, looking back and speaking just for myself, what I felt was, of course, a tremendous chus, but I did not see the full face of the Rav. I saw more from behind, from the back. Having said that, the fact remains that Baruch Hashem, I did have the chus to be in the shir for several years. And combining that fact with the fact that over subsequent years, I've had the opportunity, Baruch Hashem, to read many things that the Rav has written, Rav wrote himself, and things which his Talmidim wrote in his name. I heard many shiurim on tapes and so on. Plus the fact that my own Rebbeim, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal, the Baruch HaChaim Tov Marukim, Rav Shechter Shlita, another Rebbeim from whom I learned here in the yeshiva and elsewhere in my years in Reitz, Rav Abba Brunspiegel, Rav Yehuda Parnas, Rav Hashem Reichman, Rav Aaron Kahn, were themselves among the great Talmidim of the Rav over the years. So I heard many things from them that the Rav had said. So I believe I have something to share with you Talmidim, with this door, the door in our yeshiva, Shelo Yadas Yosef, who didn't see the Rav. Again, like was said about Rav Meir, so Chazisi Rav Yosef Ber Me'achore, I saw Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik from behind, but I still think, hopefully, there's something that I say that you'll find inspiring and give you some insight into the Rav. I'd like really to do two things in the time that we have this evening. The first, to share some remarks, some comments about the Rav, some insights into the Rav, maybe some stories, but to frame that presentation with a Dvar Torah, the thought that the Rav himself once said, not something I actually heard, but I heard from someone who was himself a fine Talmud of the Rav's. And then if there's time at the end, maybe share one or two brief insights of his that will give you a flavor of how he thought and how he learned. This week's Sedra, Parshas Emor, the Torah begins with a description of the responsibilities, the role, the restrictions relating to the Kohanim, and subsequently those relating to the Kohen Gadol. And the Torah says, in Parshas Emor, relating to the Kohen Gadol, Ki Shemen Mishchas Kodesh Olav, Ani Hashem. He was anointed with the Shemen HaMishcha. And Chazal teaches that one way in which the Kohen Gadol was Nischanech, he was initiated into his position as Kohen Gadol, was by being anointed with the Shemen HaMishcha. The Shemen HaMishcha, Chazal teaches, was Nignaz, the days of Yoshiyahu. So in the time of the Bayis Sheni, how was the Kohen Gadol initiated with Nischanech into his position? The Mishnah Megillah and Daf Tes indicates that the Kohen Gadol, by virtue of the fact that he wore the eight begodim, ribui begodim, right? He was marbe begodim, he had more, he had eight garments, as opposed to the regular Kohen Hedyot who wore four garments. So by wearing the eight garments, that was the act, or that was the thing that was Nischanech him, that initiated him into the role. So far, two things. The Shemen HaMishcha and Ribui Begadim. The Gemara in Yuma and Daf Yud Beis has a third possibility, which is for an unusual circumstance. The Gemara there is discussing what happens if the Kohen Gadol becomes pasul on Yom Kippur, and you have to put a new Kohen Gadol in, and it's at the time when you already did the Avoda of the Shemona Begadim. You know that the Kohen Gadol changed several times in the course of the day, from the special Yom Kippur Begadim back to the Eight Begadim, back to Yom Kippur Begadim, and so on. So the question is, there's no Shemen HaMishcha, and the Avodah he's about to do doesn't require Ribui Begadim. It's part of that service in Yom Kippur. It didn't require the Ribui Begadim. So what is it that was Nischanechim that initiated him into his position? So there the Gemara says, Avodoso Mechanchoso. Just doing the job, just doing the Avodah, that's what initiated him to the position. So the Rav said, Al Derech HaDrush, that these three concepts are applicable to any leader. Certainly to any Torah leader, to any leader in any position. A person sometimes steps into a role by virtue of something like the Shemen HaMishcha, which is bestowed upon him by somebody else. It's not a result of anything he did to earn that position, but the person may have certain natural talents, certain abilities or whatever, and by virtue of that, he is in a position to be a leader. Then there's the idea that's represented by the Shem HaMishkan. Then there's the idea of Ribbi B'Gadim, where the person is distinguished in his appearance or in his behavior from others. It's noticeable. It's known. This person is recognized. In Shem HaMishkan, you don't recognize it. It dries off after a while. But this Ribbi B'Gadim is something that people can see. So sometimes a person is in a position of leadership because he has done certain things that people see, and therefore they view him as a leader. And the third thing, avodas mechanchoso, sometimes you have a person who's a leader because, to use today's terms, he steps up to the plate. Not sure what natural talents he may have, not sure what people perceive, but he gets the job done. And so those three things the Rav suggested are all things which contribute to any leadership position, based on what the Torah says regarding the Kohen Gadol. The Rav stressed, as was said over to me, that the most important is the avodas mechanchoso. You have to do the job. There are many people in other fields, in other places, other disciplines that may have great natural talent, that may be acknowledged by other people because they see that this person stands out, but it doesn't do the job, then it falls flat. I think we can take this idea and suggest that the Rav Zichron Avrocha possessed all three. He had all three of these talents, or all three of these things going for him. In terms of the Shem and HaMishkan representing that which came from the outside. So the Rav came from a family which was as distinguished as any in the Jewish world. It was not something that he, quote unquote, deserved. That's the family he was born into. The family background from the Beis HaRav, going back to Chaim of Elozhin, the great Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. His father was a Moshe Soloveitchik, his grandfather was a Chaim Soloveitchik, great-grandfather of the Beis HaLevi. So he came into the world with that background. Grandfather on the other side, Abelia Feinstein, Abelia Pruziner, great Talmud Chacham, great Gedolei Torah, he came into the world with that. That's like the Shem and HaMishkan. Rav Shechter spoke a few weeks ago, he mentioned that the Rav had a brother, Shmuel Soloveitchik, who was a professor of chemistry here in the yeshiva before my time. But I'm told that he was a kibitzer a little bit. And one of the things which he said, people think my brothers, Yashaber, that's the Rav, and a Baron Soloveitchik, they're the great Gaon in the family. But he says, really, I'm the great Gaon in the family. Because you have a father of Moshe Soloveitchik, and your father, grandfather of Chaim, great-grandfather of Beis Halevi, and your big Talmud Chacham, big deal. But to come from that background and not be a big Talmud Chacham, that's Gonus. That's genius. He was a Talmud Chacham too, but that's what he said. But the Rav came from that kind of a background. So he had that going for him before he came into the world. He was educated as a young child. People know that he was very strongly influenced by a Chabad Melamed. He lived in the city of Chasalavich, where his father, Moshe Soloveitchik, was the Rav. And there was a large Lubavitcher community there. And the Melamed, the local Melamed, his name was Baruch Yaakov Riesberg, was his Melamed. And the Rav writes fondly about his memories from being in that cheder. He writes in one of the letters that was printed, he wrote a letter to a certain Lubavitcher here in America, and he writes that he remembers as a young boy sitting in the cheder, and there's a big picture of the Alter Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya, on the wall, and a picture of the Tzemach Tzedek, and he felt that it was very regal, and their appearance was so striking, and people who were clearly, the Rav's perception anyway, looking into the divine and so on, gazing at the divine and longing and so on. He writes very, very fondly of those pictures in the cheder. And the problem was that, at least the problem for his parents was, that he wasn't learning as much Gemara as they hoped he would. Aaron Lichtenstein of Havach, when he wrote something about the Rav, I think it was an article called The Rav and Jubilee, I think, in Appreciation. So he writes in his own language, he says, Moshe Soloveitchik found that the Rav, his young son, was sorely lacking in the area of learning Gemara, but his study of the Tanya, in Aaron Lichtenstein's words, proceeded merrily apace. So after that, his father took over his teaching. His father, Moshe Soloveitchik, became his Rebbe. So you have a father like that, again, you know, that's the background. That's not something you did anything to deserve. But you have a father like a Moshe Soloveitchik. And he would listen, the Rav himself records this. He would listen when he was a young boy. He would sleep on a cot that was in the hallway. As a side point, we can't really understand the poverty and the limited living quarters and limited living life, really, that the people had in those days. He writes that his bed was a cot in the hallway, And he would hear, as a young boy, the older Talmidim who came to learn Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. And he writes that he would hear and he would listen as the Rambam, their father, would quote a Rambam, and the Talmidim would ask kashas on the Rambam, the Rai would ask a kasha against the Rambam, the Talmidim would yell back and forth, and the Moshe Soloveitchik would try to figure out pshat in the Rambam. And sometimes the Rav wrote, my father was able to save the Rambam from all those who attacked him. But sometimes he got depressed because my father wasn't able to save the Rambam. The kasha was too strong. He would say to his mother, our father couldn't save the Rambam. He couldn't defend the Rambam. What's going to be? And the mother said, Rebbetzin Soloveitchik said, so one day you'll save the Rambam. Again, you grow up in that kind of a home, in that kind of a setting. Again, you can imagine sleeping on a cot in a hallway. We don't even imagine that. There's a side point. A friend of mine who was one of the shamashim of the Rav told me once his job. Those who know, the Rav used to have lived in the apartment on the ground floor of the morgue dormitory here. I think 102, I think is the number. That's where his apartment was. So they would have different boys take care of him in the later years. His wife had passed away and so on, so the boys took care of him in different years. So one of the fellows told me that part of his job was to make sure the Rav would eat. And so he would bring the Rav food, and the Rav didn't want to eat once. And he said, Rebbe, you'll be hungry. If you don't eat lunch, you're going to be hungry. So he turned, the Rav turned, the person told me the Rav turned and said, hungry? You American boys don't know what it means to be hungry. You miss a meal, you miss a snack. Oh, I'm starving. We were hungry as kids. We had nothing to eat. You know, it was I don't know what hungry means. That was the poverty. But in any event, sitting or listening on a cot, his father say shiurim and answer and defend Rambams, again, that's something that came from him from the outside. It's interesting, just as a side point, they produced a sefer, I'm sure it's here in the basement, some chidusha agram v'agrid. The Chiddush of Moshe Soloveitchik and the Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. I remember when I first bought the Sefer, I thought that be part of the first half of the Sefer, let's say, would be Chiddush of Moshe, and the second half, the Chiddush of the Rav. But that's not what it is. It's Hagram v'Hagrid. In the introduction, it explains that they kept notes, but it didn't say in the notes who said what, who asked the Kasha, who gave the Teretz, back and forth, learning back and forth. So that's why it's called Hagram v'Hagrid. Together. Together, what emerged in that sefer is what they said together. We're not really sure who asked the question, who gave the teretz on any given sugya. But again, that's the background he had. So that's the idea of the Shemana Mishra, something that stood him in good stead because of the of nothing necessarily he deserved just yet. But then we move on to the Ribu V'Gadim, that which distinguished him. The Rav had what can only be described as an astonishing array of talents and abilities, any one or two of which would set somebody apart in any field, really. He was brilliant. He had penetrating insight. He had an excellent memory, analytic, deep feelings, very sensitive. When you read how he wrote, the poetry of his writing, is somebody who's got, you know, a touched heart, so to speak. It pulls at you when you read it, the beauty of how he wrote. He was a refined person, a gentleman, in terms of his personality. He had great insight into people and personalities. Those who have read the Chomesh Drashos relating to Eretz Yisrael, the five, it was originally in Yiddish, four drashos, four speeches, but eventually made Chomesh Drashos, five addresses. So aside from the stuff about Eretz Yisrael, it's a different discussion. Just to read there, I remember when I first read it, just to read those essays and get the insights into the Avos and Yosef and other people he's talking about in Chomesh Bereishis. Aside from the points about Eretz Yisrael and Mizrahi and all that, but just the insights into the personalities of the Torah and of the Tanakh. Remarkable insight into people. He was a tremendously charismatic speaker. He knew how to hold an audience, and he could hold an audience in the palm of his hands literally for hours. That I did see. Not like in the old days, but I did see that. We used to give Yahrzeit drushes here in Lamport Auditorium, in the other building. These drushes would go on for sometimes 3-4 hours. He would say halacha for part of the time, and then he would say drush. And sometimes he would ask at the end, well, do you want to hear any more? You know, and people, you'd have hundreds and hundreds of people. The whole Lamport Auditorium was full, whatever Lamport Auditorium seats. It was full, and there were people outside. Again, I only saw it at the end, but I did see it. And people would clamor for more. He held the audience in the palm of his hand. If you listen to the old drushes, I listened to a number of the drushes in Yiddish. Now, my own Yiddish isn't great. It's good enough to understand the shiurim. I don't get the jokes. But the shiur itself, and the Rav had a good sense of humor, among his other talents. But you hear the shiur, the way he spoke. He raised his voice. He lowered his voice. It was dramatic. It was almost like a performance. And he was a charismatic and dramatic speaker. Again, all these talents, any couple of these talents would be unbelievable. But he was able to hold that crowd. Sometimes after hours. And he was a genius, really, in all disciplines, in all disciplines. There was no area in Torah and in secular disciplines where he didn't feel at home. For that reason, again, getting back to the idea of Reba Begadim, he distinguished himself. People came from all over, from other yeshivas, from other places. Those lectures, those shiurim and public lectures in hotels and other places were filled with people not only from YU and not only from his Talmidim, but people came from all over to hear him. I remember my mother, Aleiha Shalom, was not yeshiva trained or learned, but she once went to a pidyon haben that somebody had, someone she knew from our community. And that's where the Rav gave one what later became a famous speech about, the first Jewish grandfather. I think that was the one. So my mother, Aleiha Shalom, was at that with my father, and she came back, and she said, wow, I've never heard somebody speak like that. She just was taken, she heard of Rabbi Soloveitchik and so on, but okay, she wasn't in the yeshiva. But she said, wow, people came from all over. And when the Rav said something, his ideas were so compelling. You hear a pshat that he said or something he said in a sugya, and sometimes it seems so obvious that you walk away from it and you say, now why in the world didn't I think of that? It was so simple. It was so obvious. Once he said it, it was so obvious. Before then, you didn't realize it. But after he said it, it was so compelling. I've had the experience, Baruch Hashem, as a Rebbe myself, with Talmidim sometimes. Where we'll read a Rambam, and the Rebbe, another Rishonim, asks a kasha against the Rambam, and it seems there is no way out. And a student said, what could the Rambam possibly be thinking? What could he have said? All the Rayas are against him. The Rebbe's right. And then I'll present what the Rav said. See, after presenting what the Rav said, so the student said, so what did the Rebbe think? 10 minutes ago, you couldn't understand how the Rambam could possibly write. Now you don't understand what the kasha was against him. That was where the Rav presented. It was so compelling. And he was recognized by other Gedolei Torah in that regard as well. The Rav got involved in public policy sometimes. There was a certain issue once where a number of Rabbanim had agreed to sign something, some government issue. And one of the big Rabbanim, the big Rashi Yeshiva, decided at one point he was going to back out and he wanted to pull his signature off. And the Rav called him up and the Rav said to him, and he was a great Talmid Chacham, a great Rashi Yeshiva, but the Rav said, why do you want to pull your name off? You and I both know that whatever story you're going to give me, I can slug it up. We both know that. So please sign it. And he convinced them in that regard. And people understood. People understood. Rav Shechter, when he gave the hesped for the Rav here in the yeshiva 25 years ago, what they did was, Rakona or Rechon remember, for about 2 weeks after every night, a different Rosh Yeshiva presented something for a couple of weeks here, not in this basement, it just didn't exist yet, but what's now called the old base. So Rav Shechter said that he felt about the Rav that he had just a package, a whole package of chidushim, of stories, a rich tradition that he was passing on, that distinguished him. The Rav was, of course, a Baal Mechadish. Rav Shechter was excited. But the Rav wasn't Mechadish. He presented everything in such a clear way. Of course he was Mechadish, but he took the traditions, and he presented the traditions with the stories, with the backgrounds about different gedolim and things that he had picked up over his, and he shared that. Rav Shechter also once said that over the years, in his own learning, I don't think he said it on that occasion, but he did once say that over the years in his own learning, he has seen quite a number of the Rav's famous chidushim written, not exactly the same way, but by other Gedolei Torah, by other Achronim, other great Achronim. And he's seen them in print and in other places, different suggestions. Again, every Navi speaks Signon Shalom, but more or less the same ideas. But he said the greatness of the Rav was that he said all 25. You have to look in 25 other Svarim to see. He said all of them. He said, the whole package. So the Rav had it all in terms of learning. The ability in Iyun, the ability in Drush, Machshava, Halacha. There was nothing that he didn't touch that wasn't gold. And that's what set him apart. That's the idea of the Ribu Begadim. But then there is, I said, the third idea of Avarosamach Anchoso. The Rav stepped up to the plate. Many, many times, there were issues here in the yeshiva, again, more or less before my time, but I heard the stories, where he stepped up on behalf of our yeshiva, on behalf of the Orthodox community, and contributed to things when it was necessary. But perhaps most of all, or most important of all, is he worked hard. He worked hard. The Rav traveled every week from Boston to New York and back. I'm not sure if we, and again, I'll speak for myself, I didn't appreciate what that was. I didn't appreciate that. I'm not sure if the Talmidim always appreciated it. that in the olden days he had to take a train from Boston to New York. He was here for a couple of days and took a train back every week. Well, in my time, we came by plane, you know, the shuttle. But again, to have to schlep to the airport and get on a plane and get off the plane and schlep to here, to YU, you know, that's hard work. That was Mesiras Nefesh. I remember once, one of the years, one of his shamoshim, one of his misharsim, was a chavrus of mine. So part of his job was at the end of the day, my time, the Rav came in on Tuesday morning and went back to Boston on Thursday afternoon. Originally he used to come, I think, for 2 days, but in my time he came for 3 days, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So he gave shiur Tuesday around noon when he got here for a couple hours, then Wednesday for a couple hours, Thursday a couple hours, then he went back Thursday afternoon as a general rule. So this chavrus of mine was one of the shamoshim, and he had to drive him to the airport. So a couple of times I accompanied him in the car to the airport. They always wanted to have at least two talmidim going in case there'll be a problem with the car, someone be with the rub, whatever. So I didn't usually go, but a couple of times he needed me. I wasn't one of the misharsim. I wasn't one of the shamoshim. But my chavrusa was, so sometimes he needed someone else, so I went. So I remember one time, and I don't really remember the circumstances, but I remember one time what we did was, when we got to the airport, so we would actually bring the Rav onto the plane. And we got special permission, he was older and so on, so actually I walked with him onto the plane. I sat down in the seat, and there was a flight attendant there, and you know, it was helpful and so on. And then I got up to leave, right? Because in Boston, someone was meeting him, so the family would do the same thing. Would come onto the plane, take him off, and bring him back to his home in Boston. So I was on the plane, and got him sat down, took care of him, make sure he was okay. And then I'm walking away. So the flight attendant says, "You're not sitting next to him?" I said, "No." So she said, "Well, where's your seat?" So I said, "Well, my seat's in the car. I'm leaving." You know, so she said, "You're not letting this man travel by himself." So I said, "Ma'am, you may not believe this, but this man does this every single week. Every week he comes here. That's Mesiras Nefesh. That's something I think we didn't appreciate. And that's hard work in a different sense." When he worked on a sugya, it's known that he looked at every sugya that he was attacking and was struggling with, v'chol yom v'yom k'chadoshim. He would look at everything as if he was seeing it for the first time. I remember after he was nifter, again, that year, 25 years ago, they had, again, the Levaya was on Chol HaMoed, the Erev, the last days of Pesach, it was a Sunday. So they had, a lot of people were away, Pesach, they had here in YU a couple of weeks later, again, in Lamport Auditorium, a big Askara, the beginning of Iyar. And one of the speakers was the Rav's son, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and he said about his father that he recalls once learning something with his father. I'll never forget this. He said they were having difficulty with the sugya and spending a couple days trying to figure out what the Gemara means, what Tosfos means, and so on. And finally, the son, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, got a little frustrated, and he said, "Listen, Pa, you said shiurim in this mesecht in yeshiva a couple of years ago. Why don't you go look in your notes and see how you explained the sugya then? We can go further." And the way Chaim described it, he said, "My father looked at me with a type of disdain that you would have if you opened the drawer and you would see cockroaches jumping around and you're taken aback. That's how my father looked at me." And he said, "That's not how we learn. That's not how we learn. It doesn't matter what I said in the shiur 2 years ago. We have to figure it out now." Every time it was like it was brand new. One of the Rav's grandchildren, Yitzhak Lichtenstein, put out a number of years ago, and I recently republished it, the Haggadah called Siach Hagrid. I'm sure many of you have seen it. If you don't, you want to hear read some of the Rav's insights into Pesach, the halachas, not Jewish, but the halachas of Pesach. So it's certainly Kedai and doesn't need my recommendation. But Yitzhak Lichtenstein writes in a brief Hakdama, he writes one line which I thought really encapsulates the Rav. He said, I hope I'm quoting accurately. Kol ma shalomad matza bo chiddush. Whatever he learned, there was a chiddush. Whatever he saw, there was a way to analyze to come up with a chiddush. Kol ma shalomad matza bo chiddush. And it didn't matter what the subject was. It didn't matter if it was in the Haggadah, it was about Moda Ani. It doesn't matter what it's about. Whatever he saw, if something was part of our tradition, something part of our liturgy, part of our Shas, part of our Minhagim, then that was interesting to him, and he found the Chiddush in it. A couple years ago, I had the privilege to work on the Machzorim that was printed with the insights of the Rav. I was one of the editors, so it was printed by Art Scroll. So at one point, there was a meeting. And I was at the meeting, I forgot exactly what it was about, but we were discussing some of the things we were printing in that machzor. So, you know, on Kol Nidre, Kippur night, so there is a passage from the Zohar that is recorded in many, many machzorim, printed right by Kohn. It starts, Kom Reb Shimon. I don't know that many people who say it. Perhaps in the Hasidic world they say it. I've never said it. Usually it's hard enough to finish Tefillah Zakah in time, you know, before Kol Nidre starts. But there is a passage from the Zohar, Kom Reb Shimon. And the Rav had a comment on this Kom Reb Shimon, which we included in the Machzor. And one of the people from Art Scroll, one of the editors and so on, one of the head people there, said, I'm surprised he had a comment on this passage, Kom Reb Shimon. I said, why are you surprised? He said, I didn't think, it's from the Zohar, I didn't think that was his thing. Everything was his thing. If it's part of our tradition, if there are Rabbim and Shleimim who say it, who incorporate, it didn't matter. I don't know whether he said it or not. I have no idea. I would tend to doubt it, but I have no idea. But it didn't matter. Everything was his thing. Everything he approached, and he came up with a chiddush. People are aware, this I heard in my years already, almost anybody who studied by the Rav knows, that he was very insistent, in general, that one should follow the menhagim of one's family. But one of the exceptions that he felt was Sukkah on Shmini Atzeres, learning Sukkah this year. Sukkah on Shmini Atzeres. He felt you have to, it says in the Gemara, you have to eat in the Sukkah on Shmini Atzeres. Hagam, the people from a Hasidic background, they don't, they make Kiddush in the day, different menhagim. But the Rav felt very strongly that one should eat in the Sukkah on Shmini Atzeres. And he said, even if that's not your family minhag, he felt that that's something that people should do. Despite that, however, he has, that I know of, at least two interpretations of the other minhag. I think Reichman has one in his Sefer, and the Rishimas and Sukkah, and the other written in a different way. In other words, it didn't matter what he held. If this is something which many Jews do, then there's got to be a reason for it. And I'm going to figure out what the reason is. I'm going to say a chiddush in that. Because everything was his thing. Fundamentally, the Rav viewed himself, and he said this on more than one occasion, I think I heard it directly, I certainly heard it on a tape, that he viewed himself as a melamed. He's dead, you know, we called him the Rav. Rashefta spoke about how that title came. But he viewed himself as a melamed, as a teacher. And he said, that's not such a bad title, because that's what we say about a Kodesh Baruch Hu, in the Birchas HaTorah. We say, HaMelamed Torah L'Am Yisrael. Baruch Atah Hashem, HaMelamed Torah L'Am Yisrael. That's a compliment also. But he fundamentally viewed himself as a melamed, as somebody who wanted to teach. And therefore he was always prepared. I don't think there was any time, at least that I know of, that the Rav got up and decided to wing it. And he's going to get up and just wing it. He always prepared. He generally spoke from notes. He wrote things down. Somebody told me, and I'm not an eyewitness to the story, but somebody told me that in Boston, in the Maimonides Yeshiva Day School that he founded, so he was invited to speak to the third grade class or whatever when he finished Chumash Bereishis or whatever it was, Parsha Lech or whatever they were learning. And they make a siyum. So the Rav came in to say a few words. And this is what I was told. When he got up, he took out of his pocket a piece of paper, opened it up, he prepared the remarks for the little kids. The story of that same time when one time he was walking in the halls, and right outside the hall he saw outside one of the classrooms he saw there was a young boy crying, and he asked him what's the matter, and the boy said, well, I have a Chumash test today or a Navi test today, and I forgot to study, and now I don't know when to pass, and he was very, very upset. So the Rav said, come with me, I'll study it with you. So the boy said, are you sure you know it? No. But in any event, this idea that he prepared for everything that he did was also something. There was once a dinner for one of the tzedakah, it might have been Chinuch Atzmai, I'm not positive, where they convinced the Rav to be the guest of honor at the dinner. And at first he wanted to stay away from it. He said, I don't want it, I don't have time, I have to give a speech, I don't have time to prepare, and so on and so forth. But eventually they told him, you'll be the guest of honor, you don't have to give a drasha. You don't have to speak, you won't have to speak, it's okay. So on that condition he accepted it. Came the dinner, and the person who was in charge of the dinner, they presented whatever plaque or whatever it was. They said, dinner. He said, and the chairman of the dinner said, I know that we told Rav Soloveitchik that he doesn't have to speak, but he's here already. Rav Soloveitchik, won't you please honor us by saying a few words? And the Rav got up and he said, I knew you were going to do that. And he took a piece of paper out and he had prepared his remarks. But he prepared when he spoke. The joke is, the Rav used to give, this is not a joke, the Rav used to give hespedim. I remember hearing a couple of them here. I think the last time I heard him speak publicly was a hesped here in Lamp Auditorium. And he really, again, as I said before, captured the person. He was able to capture the person's essence and frame it with Dvar Halacha, with Dvar Torah, in a way that's really unmatchable. And the joke he used to say was, if someone wants me to speak at the Levaya, I need at least 3 weeks' notice. The Rav was also very given over to his Talmidim. He really lived to a certain extent for the shiur that he gave. In those days, at least in my time, the shiur was on the fourth floor, first hall. Now they made it into office. I think it's the public relations or something on the fourth floor. Okay, but it used to be the rooms were kind of laid out differently, so that's where the shiur used to be, on the fourth floor, first hall. And as was mentioned, I think previously, for many years, the Rav gave a Chumash shiur in the evenings, on Tuesday evenings, in a downtown shul called Moria. I was not there, it was before my time. But many people used to go every week to hear the Rav give shiurim on not only Chumash. I mean, he gave Gemara, and in the end he said on Chumash. He did different Masechtas, I think he did the Halacha L'Maisa Masechtas, no, I think Megillah and Brachas and so on. And then he would say Chumash at the end. That was over by the time I was a Talmud. But one fine day, one fine Tuesday, I remember it was part of the week of Parshas Vayishlach, if I'm not mistaken, the Rav announced in the regular shiur upstairs on the fourth floor, I'm going to give a Chumash shiur tonight. Okay? So we all certainly went, and he gave a Chumash shiur. And his Chumash shiur were, again, Hashem Dover, the insight. Well, by the following week, the word had gotten out, and the Rav was giving a shiur on Chumash on Tuesday nights. So people packed into the fourth floor. There was no room. The whole hallway was filled and so on. So they asked him to move it up for the following week to 501. It's a bigger room. And he didn't really want to because he wanted this for his shiur and not for the public. But he acquiesced. But he said on condition that the room should be set up in such a way that the boys in the shiur should sit around his desk in that horseshoe fashion, you know, and then they can have chairs for the rest of the visitors who want to come. He was very, very muster to his shiur. There's a story that I think was told as part of this series, I know it was told on other occasions, of his relationship with his Talmidim, of a circumstance once when the Rav said something, and one of the Talmidim challenged what the Rav said, and he paused, and he thought, and he said, either he ripped up his papers, his notes, or he said the shiur is over, the Talmud is right, and so on, only the next day to show that the Talmud is wrong. I have a different insight into that story, because the subject of the story is my late father-in-law, Zichron Avrocha, Chaim Shulman, who was one of the Rav's outstanding Talmidim in his time. And he told me the story a little differently. He said that he was in the shiur, and the Rav, maybe even told me the sugu it was Yodei Iker Shabbos and so on. Anyway, so he said that he said something in the name of the Ran. I say it over in the Mashpoh. He told me the Ran, whoever it was, okay. He said it over to some of the name of the Ran, the Rishonim, and the Rav thought, and it's true. And he said, okay, that's it. Now, first of all, it shows an interesting thing. My guess is the Rav could have fumfered his way out. No, I mean, he could have said something that confused the Talmidim, and he could have gotten out of it. That's what perhaps many people would do, right? Could have said, well, it was creative enough to figure out, but if it's not Emes, it's not Emes. That's the story with Reb Chaim. That Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was once, when there was a question about his suitability to deliver a shiur in Valozhin, so he had to give a model lesson, you know, a proper shiur, and he was saying over something from the Rambam, when he recalled in the middle that there's a parish on Mishnayis in the Rambam someplace in Taras that says not like he was saying, and therefore he said in front of these people, I'm wrong. Now, it could be that the other people would not have recalled that parish on Mishnayis in Taras just then anyway, and he could have fetched a way out, but he didn't. And the Rav had that same mid of honesty. But the way the story, when my father-in-law told me the story, was he went back to the Beis Medrash, and he read, and he said, oh, he misquoted. Meaning he himself, not the Rav, he himself misquoted this Rishon. And he came back to the Rav the next day and told him, Rebbe, I'm sorry, misquoted. And the Rav said, that's the last time I trust you. And that was... But as I say, he was given over to his Talmidim, and he was given over to the Shir. I'll just mention one story that I personally experienced. There's one point that the Rav... I wanted to consult the Rav about a certain Shiloh. So I made an appointment. Again, he would be in the room in that apartment on the first floor of the morgue dormitory. And he made an appointment with one of the Misharsim and went to come at a certain time. So I came at the time I was supposed to come to ask the Shiloh. And they told me, okay, it was my turn. Someone else came out. I could go in. And I'll never forget this. I lived to be 120. I walked into the room. The Rav was sitting on a chair. And there was a small table. And next to the table was a TV cart that had not a TV, but a Shas and a Rambam. And he was slumped over in his chair like this, kind of like leaning over. He didn't have a jacket and a tie, just a white shirt and pants. He was sitting there. And it looked to me as if I blew hard enough, I could blow him over. And I remember thinking to myself, Taubes, you fool. What are you bothering him for? There were other Talmid Chachamim, other poskim, Baruch Hashem, in the yeshiva. It wasn't the type, it was an important shaila, but it wasn't the type of shaila that needed the Rav's unique. I could have asked someone else and gotten the psal. What am I going to go bother the Rav now? Look what he looks like. And, you know, he looked like he was about to fall over. And I remember that before I went in with the shaila, I'd looked up some of the issues in case there'd be a discussion. I don't want to look like a complete amoret, so like I tried to have some fluency in what was going on. And I was so like flustered and taken aback. I just asked the question quickly. He said something, and I ran out of there. I felt terrible. Less than 45 minutes later was the shiur upstairs on the fourth floor, and I could not believe it was the same person. He walked in. He was animated. He's banging on the table. He's saying this. Before, it looked like he was about to fall over. And now, in the shir, he was anatz Eitz Chaim, Heil, and Machzikim Bo. Right? The people who want to give over shir, want to give over Torah, and that's what the Rav wanted to do. To teach us, to teach us how to think, to give over to his Talmidim. That's the idea of Avod Osam and Chanchoso. He certainly stepped up to the plate in so many different ways. I just like, and I'm sorry for going a little bit over, but I just want to share very quickly two thoughts of his, which may give you some insight into how he thought, and they're both a little bit minyan of the Yomah. This week's sedra, we have the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer. Of course, in the middle of Sfiras HaOmer. So the Gemara says, those who study the Gemara know, Menachas Daf Samach Vav, the Gemara says that really there's a mitzvah to count both the days and the weeks. We'll do it in a few minutes, right? We mentioned both the days and the weeks. And some say that the weeks means only the end of the week, but our practice is we mention each night, the day and the week, and so on. But the Gemara then says, Amemar, at the end of the sugi on Samach Vav and Halakha, says, Amemar, he would only mention the days, not the weeks. Why? Zeichel HaMikdash. So Zeichel HaMikdash. The way Rashi seems to say, is since it's only a Zeichel HaMikdash anyway, so you don't have to bother saying the weeks, saying the days is good enough. The question is it such a big deal to say the week's only? Oh, it's only a Zeichel HaMikdash. I mean, it's so hard to say that it takes another 1.5 seconds. I mean, it's not as if it's a big thing now, so it's a Zeichel HaMikdash. We'll make life easier. It's not such a difficult thing. So the Rav explained that, you know, we have, those who are studying Sukkah, the end of the third parak, we have the idea that Lulav was instituted, Kol Shiva, outside the Mikdash, as a Zeichel HaMikdash. And the Gemara quotes a pasuk as a source for the Zeichel HaMikdash. Tzioni, Darish Einla, Mikal Deboi, Drisha, right? The Gemara says that we have to remember the Mikdash. Quotes a pasuk. And the Lulav, Kol Shiva, enables us to remember the Beis HaMikdash. Because that's what the Beis HaMikdash, Smachna, Mifnei HaShem, Okechem, Shiva Tzionim. In Baba Basra, at the end of the third parak, the end of Cheska Batim, Daf Samech, the Gemara has a whole list of things, some of which, you know, people know from today, that we do to remember the Mikdash, or that we don't do. You don't paint, you know, you leave a part of the house unpainted, and other things, you know, that are mentioned there. We don't, we deprive ourselves a little bit to the time of a simcha, different things. And there, the Gemara quotes as the makor for Zeichel HaMikdash, a different pasuk, Yimeshkachech Yerushalayim, now it's popular to sing it at a chasen, we break the glass, right? So, Yimeshkachech Yerushalayim, Tishkach Yemini. So I've said, why the two different psukim? Why in one place the Gemara says Zeichel HaMikdash is derived from Tzion Hidorish Ein Lo, and the other place it's derived from Mishkach Yerushalayim Tishkach Yemini. So the Rav said, and this is just an example of his insight, because there are two different types of Zeichel HaMikdash. Sometimes we recall the Mikdash by trying to replicate what they did in the Mikdash. And other times, we dafka don't do things. We do things that show we're depriving ourselves because there's no more Mikdash. If I may, and I don't think he said it this way, but a Zeichel HaMikdash versus a Zeichel HaChorban. And that's why they're two different psukim. And that's what Amemar meant. When Amemar said, I'm only counting the days and not the weeks because the Zeichel HaMikdash, it's because this kind of Zeichel HaMikdash, and it fits in very well with the Baal HaMoed and the Pesachim, who says that the mitzvah Sfiras HaOmer altogether is really, it's a sad mitzvah, it reminds us of the Churban and so on. That's why we say, Tosa says, that's why we say right after the Sfira, we say that Lili Hiratzon, right, you know, Harachamu Yachzulano, right? We recall the Mikdash. So Amemar Dafka, not that he said, oh, it's only a Zeichel HaMikdash, we don't have to work as hard. No. He wants to say that since it's the type of Zeichel, this type of Zeichel HaMikdash, that's Dafka why we shouldn't do it the way it was done in the Mikdash. That's a perception. That's an example of the depth, just analysis. Solving a problem with two different Gemaras, right, two different sources for Zeichel HaMikdash, and applying it to what's otherwise a puzzling remark by Amemar. That gives you some insight. And finally, you may... You know, this past Shabbos, we learned Achrei Mos and Kedoshim. Usually when there's a double sedra, we read the haftarah from the second sedra, my desolak mine. That's a general rule, and there's a double, next week will be Bahar b'chukosai. So we're going to read the haftarah b'chukosai. Usually you read the haftarah of the second sedra. Hachemos kedosh, an exception. This is the Ramor way. So some say it has to do with the Haftar of Kedoshim. Haftar of Kedoshim speaks about Toivos Yerushalayim. You know, it's embarrassing and stuff, so we don't read it. But the truth is, we don't only read the Haftar of Achrimos when it's Achrimos Kedoshim combined, but even when they're separate, if for whatever reason we didn't read the Haftar of Achrimos, for example, sometimes Achrimos is Shabbos HaGadol, in the leap year, so you read the Haftar of Shabbos HaGadol. Sometimes Achrimos lands on Rosh Chodesh, do you read the Haftar of Rosh Chodesh? Actually, I think, I don't know Rosh Chodesh, I think Mocha Chodesh. So in that sense, in that year, you also read for Kedoshim the Haftarah of Parshas Achrimos. And some suggest when Achrimos and Kedoshim are separate and there's nothing else that interrupt, you read the same Haftarah twice. What's going on? So again, you see how the Rav looked at Chumash. He noticed something in Parshas Achrimos. Parshas Achrimos, we just learned, has for the first time that our right to Eretz Yisrael can be taken away. Up until then in the Chumash, it's going to be given to promise to the Avos, and Eretz Zavas Chal Avadash, and so on. They're given to the Avos. But suddenly, in Parshas Achrimos, we find we can be thrown out. If we don't deserve it, we kicked out. That's pretty depressing. The Haftar of Parshas Achrimos, Aleichus Nekushim, ends, Below Yenosu Ol Malad Mosom. There's a Haftacha that will come a time, we'll go back to Eretz Yisrael, we'll never be thrown out again. So the Rav said, I heard this from myself. He said, you can't go through Parshas Achrimos. You can't read a statement that will be thrown out of Eretz Yisrael without at some point reading that nechama from the Navi Amos of Elo Yinosu Al Muslim. We won't be thrown out again. Again, just a way to look at something carefully, something we all do, something we see. The Rav looked at it and it came up with such a beautiful interpretation. It's difficult in conclusion to speak about him in the sense that I, as I said at the outset, I saw only a glimpse, and there are plenty of people who can say much, much more. But it's hard to imagine such all-encompassing greatness, which he tried to share. As I said, he viewed himself as a malabit, and he wanted to teach people how to think. Not to say, well, the Rambam says this, I'll give you teretz. He wanted you to figure out the teretz. He wanted you to work on it. But I got a glimpse of some of that greatness, which was revealed by himself, or by his Talmidim, from what I learned. And I hope as well that you'll gain some insight from this whole series of hearing who the Rav was, that you'll also have a little bit of a glimpse of him, that some of his greatness will be revealed, and Bez Hashem will be continued to reveal by more analysis and more discussions of what the Rav is and who he was and what he accomplished. Yehi Zichro Baruch. Thank you.